Today on Movie Wallace, we initiate our coverage of the Toronto International Film Festival 2018. It's time for Movie Wallace. Hi, this is Joe.
Hi, it's Rashmi.
And Yazdi as well.
Movie Wallace is your weekly dose of film reviews, movie news and general banter in theatres, on DVD, online streaming or in the back of an airplane. If you love the movies, this show is for you.
And if you love the movies, you should be here at TIFF or Toronto International Film Festival 2018. We finally made it.
Yes, and it is amazing.
It's amazeballs. Yeah. I never use that word, but this is pretty amazing.
So I think the last time we did any coverage for Toronto was in 2014, Yazdi, when you came on your own.
Mm-hmm.
As as a civilian, just a kind of a movie lover. We didn't have any official press coverage, but this year, thanks to Rashmi's rather persistent knocking on doors, we've managed to get to do some official coverage of the film festival. So we hope that the listeners out there will enjoy our coverage. And in today's podcast, I guess we can just kind of kick things straight off, because as is always the case with film festivals, it is a pretty intense thing for us to cover as podcasters. We do kind of 8 to 10 hours of movies a day, then we come back and we try and record a podcast. So here we are at 11:30.
Albeit in our pajamas.
Yeah, and I must say, you know, we do a lot of film festivals, but this one I think is special because I think the audience participation, the energy, every single screening, no matter how obscure it might be, or the latest film,
it's full.
You know, Jake Gyllenhaal is on the street and people are screaming, and, you know, all the actors show up, and we've seen,
many.
Know, Julianne Moore and, you know, Kate Beckinsale, and everybody shows up, and that whole street where the venues are,
mm-hmm.
It's closed off for the public. It's a proper festival. It's not just a festival. It's a proper festival. There are street vendors. There's music going on. There's energy in the air.
There's actually still music going on outside the hotel.
Yeah.
It's interesting. Yeah. I mean, I've never been to Toronto before, but it feels like this whole town has turned into the festival.
Yeah.
There's, you know, TIFF signs everywhere. And like you say, Yazdi, it feels like the whole city has come out to watch movies, which is a wonderful feeling, actually. I mean,
it's wonderful.
We've been to a couple of other film festivals, you know, LA and Tribeca, and, you know, they always feel like the cities accommodate and dwarf the film festival. But with Toronto being, here we are, you know, right in the middle of downtown, it feels like this city is the film festival.
Yeah. It's kind of like South by Southwest.
It's swaying with the vibe of it. Yeah. South by Southwest has that similar feel to it.
Yeah.
But, you know, that festival is also about music and it's also about interactive.
Yeah.
Here we have, pure dedication to movies. So it's a cool thing to behold.
Yeah, and I think if you're a movie lover, you should get your butt to Toronto at some point or the other. For two other reasons, I think. One is that the Venice Film Festival and then the Toronto, which follows immediately the next week, officially sets off Oscar seasons. All the Oscar hopefuls, you know, get released at or get shown at Venice and then Toronto and then the New York Film Festival. And I think the other thing also which kind of differentiates Toronto Film Festival is that they have a rule that a fixed number of seats have to be reserved for civilians. So not all the seats can be given away to press and industry
folks.
So you always have a chance of watching the films and watching the directors and the film stars. So if you love the movies, oh man, this is the place to be.
Yeah. Great choice, Yazdi.
Yes.
Yeah. And notwithstanding, I mean, you know, the one piece of advice I'd give to anybody is, you know, if you are interested in coming, you know, you got to be on your game. I mean, the ticket buying process, I think, still has a lot to be deserved, a lot to be improved upon, rather. So, do be organized and find out, do your homework, Google the website. There's always lots of great information about which movies are coming, who's directed them, what they're about and who's in them. So that would be the only piece of advice.
Yeah, and not to go on, but, you know, a good tip is become a TIFF member, even if you're not from Toronto. It's $75, about 95 Canadian dollars, and it lets you buy tickets a good 3 days before everybody else, and it's so worth it because everything sells out.
Yeah, I haven't seen a single empty seat since I've been here. Mm-hmm. So, okay, well, let's get into the meat of our content, which is obviously talking about the movies. And you know, just as a reminder, Movie Wallahs, we are often very strict with our regular podcasting to not talk about the movies before we talk about them on the podcast. And you know, the exception tends to be film festivals, in part because, you know, they often have audience Q&As, and the whole experience is kind of so intense that, you know, producing the show and being ready for it often entails a little bit of discussion ahead of time. So you know, wanting to you know, let you know that the format's going to be a little different. We don't usually score at film festivals. You know, we want to give you as much of as we can of our thoughts on the thing, but format will be a little different to our formal reviews, in part because we're really just drinking up the atmosphere of it all, and hopefully these movies will eventually get a release, and you can get a good sense for whether or not these ones are worth your while. So the four movies that we covered on day one of the film festival, for us at least, were Laura, Outlaw King, Hotel Mumbai, and Gloria Bell. So I suggest that we tackle them in that order. And I guess we can start with the movie Loro. Rashmi, you're going to tell us about that one.
Yes, Loro, which actually means them in Italian, is directed and written by Paolo Sorrentino. Yes, that Paolo Sorrentino, who wrote one of Joe's most favorite movies called The Great Beauty in 2013. I'm being facetious, as always.
The sarcasm there is
La Grande Levazza.
Yes. Yes, the sarcasm is because Joe got very irritated by all the people dancing in that movie. But then he did redeem himself with you, Joe, didn't he, when he did Youth, I think 2 years ago.
A year or two ago with Michael Caine.
Beautiful movie, yeah. And the amazing Jane Fonda as well. Anyway, so Paolo Sorrentino is actually back this year. Now, what he's done is, in Italy, Loro 1 and Loro 2 are both released this year. And what he's done specifically for the film festival is that he's actually re-edited the movie and combined both movies, which were about an hour and 40-something minutes, into a 150-minute movie, which is a movie we saw yesterday. So basically, this stars a whole host of people. Screenplays by Paolo Sorrentino and Umberto Contarello. And the cast is Tony Servillo, who's kind of worked with him in the past. Elena Sofia Ricci, Riccardo Scamarcio, and Kasia Smutniak. And a whole host of others. So, Yazdi, why don't you kick off TIFF 2018 and tell us what you thought of Loro?
So Loro is quite something. It's a big movie. It's big in many ways. It's big in terms of its scope. It's big in terms of its ideals, and it's certainly visually very big. So,
yes, and one. Sorry, I forgot to actually give you the description of what it was about. Yes. I was so excited about the fact that this was Paolo Sorrentino. But basically, the description is that it's really his skewered version of Italian politics. This is a satire, and it's basically an imaginative fictionalization of the controversial Italian tycoon and politician, Silvio Berlusconi, and his inner circle. So that's really what it's about.
Who is never referred to formally by name in the movie.
He's referred to as Silvio only, and the fact that he's a politician.
Yeah. So I think it's a movie with a lot of big ideas, and I think we didn't go in realizing that this movie is the re-edited international version, which is kind of a amalgamation of Loro 1 and Loro 2, which are released separately in Italy. But setting that aside, as overstuffed and large as the movie is in terms of its ideas, I think all the hallmarks that we have come to recognize now from Paolo Sorrentino's movies, starting with La Grande Bellezza, or The Great Beauty, and we saw again in Youth as well, this idea of older men dealing with the beauty of younger women and kind of looking back wistfully. You see that same thing here in this movie. I think that's a theme which runs through most of his movies. And I think he, as a director, is in that stage where he's an older person looking back at, you know, kind of fondly at what happened in his earlier life. And I think he finds a really good ploy here in the form of this, you know, Italian prime minister who was, you know, at that time probably the most... reviled individual in Italian politics. And it also allows him to kind of engage in what has become his visual motif, which is these dreamy landscapes, these musical numbers, these scenes where women are dancing, and some men, women are dancing with like abandon. And the camera just loves to gaze across bodies, attractive bodies. And I think, you know, as big as the movie is, I think more than half of it is just musical numbers of the camera lovingly caressing these bodies. But be that as it may, I think in Berlusconi, he's found a really good foil for what might ail us currently. And not to get too political, but there is a certain figure right now in our politics who, when we think about it, is remarkably similar to Berlusconi and what happened with him. This person who came from...
Are you talking about a billionaire turned politician?
I'm talking about, a billionaire turned politician.
That may or may not have a fondness for women outside of his marital
situation. Yes, who has a fondness for women outside of his marital and who had lots of big companies and, you know, who essentially, you know, won the trust or the love of the common people and was able to maintain his reign as a politician. So I think it's
despite allegations of corruption from various directions.
Yes, allegations of corruption, allegations of sexual impropriety. So, but be that as it may, I think it's quite a fun movie to watch. It has a lot of ideas. It has a lot going on in the movie.
So Joe, did this one piss you off as much, given there was a lot of dancing in this one?
So, I mean, I have to address that head on. I mean, the first movie that I saw by this director was the movie called The Great Beauty, which came out a few years ago. And I found the whole thing rather frustrating. We didn't see it in the we weren't able to see that in the movie theater. We saw it as a promotional screener, or rather an award screener. And the thing that frustrated me with that one was, at the beginning of the movie, at least, it seemed to have scenes of people dancing with abandon for, I would say, close to half an hour, and very little in terms of plot to kind of string those sequences together. And I know it was intended to create kind of a visual sequence, a visual piece of storytelling, but as somebody who wasn't prepared for that kind of visual attack, so to speak. I found the movie rather frustrating and gave up on it. Everything was redeemed, as Rashmi mentioned, with the movie Youth a couple of years ago with Michael Caine, which was a stunning, rather kind of introspective look at aging and, especially, I think, to some extent on the male psyche. I think, as Yazdi, you've pointed out, the focus is very much on the male gaze of the female form. Mm-hmm. But the movie had a lot of things to say about getting old, about getting wise, about so many different things, and it did so in a way that was, sort of contemplative. Youth was not an aggressive movie in terms of its plot. I'm going to say right off the bat, I thought this movie was excellent. I think I struggled to some extent with the sheer amount of content here. And Rashmi, you mentioned Loro 1 and Loro 2. The movie is almost two movies intercut into one. And, you have the Silvio Berlusconi character, and then there's another character by the name of
Sergio,
who is kind of an up-and-coming individual. He wants to get involved in the political scene in terms of getting influence from politicians, and he obviously has great ambitions. So the movie kind of cuts back and forth between them, and then kind of leaves us hanging to some extent. I kind of wonder what was left on the cutting room floor by putting these movies together. But it had so much to say, and I think, like I say, I felt almost exhausted by it, if I was to be critical in some way, and I don't want that to sound negative in any way. It just had so many different things to say about the nature of politics, of government, of men and women, sexual politics. Yesterday you make the point that it does ogle the female form extensively, and I think I'm sure Rashmi's going to have something to say about that, because there are large sections of this movie where
what is large, Joe?
Oh gosh, yeah. I mean, we get to spend I would say a good 45 minutes just ogling female form. So, you know, that's obviously not too offensive to me, but I can imagine that it could be a little tiresome for some. But, I mean, it's spectacular. I think it's incredibly ambitious, and I think it achieves what it does. It had me thinking about many things in terms of politics. The references you mentioned, Jazzy, didn't escape me either. So, I think there are parallels to be drawn with US politics and with politics and politicians and men in power in general. But I thought this movie was terrific.
Yep. Third like from me as well. So from the opening beautiful credits with this traditional Italian music playing as we pan over the ocean onto this beautiful island, to an opening scene of a sheep walking into a beautiful home and literally being killed by the AC unit turning down and down and down. I thought, oh my God, here we are again. Joe's going to hate this movie. But it turns into something a little bit different. And what I got from this was a lot of symbolism and everything that you guys have said around the politics that stands. To me, what I took away from this movie was this very clever narrative about someone who's looking back on their life with regret over what's been lost. And there's some beautiful lines in the movie that are translated into English. It's an Italian movie film, but it's beautiful to watch. And that's what kept me interested. And even with all of the female form, it was all very beautiful to watch. I would say it suffers a little bit from being on the edge of Pussycat Dolls at times, or a music video at times. And I think when he steers away from that is when we get the delight. But I can understand why he's put it all as part of the movie. Mm-hmm. I think we are supposed to get a sense of how sleazy this world was and what was used to convince people to either come on side or decide one way or another. So very smart, very clever, very funny at times, and a great performance by all in the movie, especially the lead character who is, I've just lost his name, who was actually on the stage, Tony Servillo, who actually plays Silvio Berlusconi. Great performances, really, really good movie. I would absolutely encourage everyone go out and watch this, especially if you like youth and if you like the great beauty. To me, this is kind of the two of them in a bowl mixed together.
And if possible, watch it on a big screen, because the sound design is exceptional. The visual flourishes are incredible. I agree with you. There's an almost endless number of these musical numbers of women just writhing on stage.
It's literally like an MTV music video.
And that's exactly what I wrote. It's like a cross between an 80s MTV video and maybe like a Penthouse video. It's like a kind of a mix between those two, or maybe like a Helmut Newton photo shoot, like where it's very overtly sexual, but it's not inappropriate somehow.
Yeah.
He's a very visual director. I mean, I think that's clear. And I think, you know, the movie is certainly a lot more accessible, excuse me, than The Great Beauty, because, you know, despite the dance numbers that you keep referring to, I never felt overwhelmed by any of that. I felt like it was all absolutely in service of character and in service of the story, whereas, you know, Great Beauty kind of felt, you know, abstract in that regard. And it wasn't full of as many visual metaphors. I mean, I think the sheep you mentioned at the beginning, Rashmi, of the movie was obviously clearly a visual metaphor for who knows. I mean, you know, we interpret it in different ways. I think, you know, we discussed this over food yesterday, I think. And, you know, I interpreted it to be, you know, perhaps of the people. You were thinking it was perhaps more of him in wolf's clothing. Or,
yeah, I was thinking more it's the character Berlusconi himself, who kind of appeared as a wolf in sheep's clothing to his people.
But it's not over full of these kind of abstract metaphors. And you know, the movies that kind of frustrate me in that regard are those that, you know, they're
non-linear.
Well, anything by the guy that made Dogtooth.
Yorgos
Lanthimos. Yeah, this isn't that, you know, it does have those. Again, I think he's just a very visual director. He knows how to use the camera. He knows how to tell his story.
Yeah, and I think Sorrentino is very celebrated because he always leaves a little bit of a puzzle for you as a viewer to kind of solve, and he doesn't kind of give you all the obvious answers. And here too, I think it's in the name of the movie, Them, and I think it's telling about this whole endless, you know, dichotomy between us versus them.
And who is the them?
Who is the
them? Changes depending on which situation you're in, and I think he manages to capture that. I would say it's very hedonistic.
Yeah, definitely.
This is a very hedonistic movie.
And you know, I don't know when this movie was written and when it played out, and I think it was released this year, but you know, it predates the Trump presidency, I think, in terms of at least its conception. But it has lines where the Silvio character says, you know, the left cannot figure me out at one point. Another point he says, can you guess how many books have been written attacking me? I mean, it's amazing that all those things which were applicable to Berlusconi, you know, mm-hmm. kind of fit almost to a T with Donald Trump. So it could be a very prescient movie as well. So yeah. Definitely worth a watch.
But the other similarity there is, you know, I think whether it's true or not, I think the personality types are quite similar in that mm-hmm. they are seeking adoration, and they are seeking to be would I describe our current president as populist? Maybe not, but they are definitely seeking to have the love of the people, and you know, within that there are many inherent character flaws, but again, terrific exploration of and satire. Let's move on. Movie number two of the day was Outlaw King, or should I say Outlaw / King? And Yazdi, yes, I think you're going to tell us about that.
I can tell you a bit about Outlaw King. Outlaw King is the latest from director David McKenzie. And he has a really impressive filmography. I mean, he made movies like The Last Great Wilderness. He did Young Adam with Ewan McGregor. He did Start Up, which was a prison drama. He did Perfect Sense, again with Ewan McGregor and Evergreen. And then perhaps his most celebrated film was Hell or High Water, which came out 2 years ago, which I think the San Diego Film Critics Society named the best film of the year, and rightly so. It's a brilliant film. It's about as Americana as it gets, which is amazing considering that, you know, it was made by a director who is based in Scotland. So here's his latest film, and I think it's kind of a departure for him because he tackles full on a historical epic here. And it's essentially the story of Robert Bruce, or the King of Scots, and his story. And forced into exile by the English after being crowned King of Scotland, legendary warrior Robert the Bruce fights to reclaim the throne in the latest from director David McKenzie. So this is this is a movie which has a pretty big name actors and actresses. It has Chris Pine in the lead role as Bruce. Aaron Taylor-Johnson is here. Florence Pugh, who is up and coming, and Stephen Delane is here as well. So this movie is being distributed by Netflix. So it'll be interesting to see if it shows up in theaters, although I hope it does because this is a pretty grand epic movie, or if it goes straight to Netflix. But what do you guys think about Outlaw / King?
So I was really excited to see this because Hell or High Water was one of my favorite movies of last year. And I think, Yassi, didn't we give it the best movie of the year at the San Diego Film Critics?
Yeah, I just said that. Yeah.
Okay, so look, this is set in 1304. That's what I wrote down. And I mm-hmm. I didn't know much about, I mean, obviously I know about British history because we studied it at school, but I didn't necessarily know a lot of the divide between Scotland and England. And of course, we've all watched your favorite film, Joe.
Braveheart.
So this is the follow on, as you reminded us after we had watched the movie. This is really, really well done. I think what works for me really well is that it's epic, it's bloody, it's brutal, but at its core, it's this beautiful love story. And I love me a good love story. So not quite as good, I would say, not as excellent as Hell or High Water, but a great, great entry, showing us that this is a force to be reckoned with. This is a great director. And of course, Chris Pine is amazing in the lead role. I really enjoyed this movie. The Full Frontal helped.
And the Full Frontal Rashmi's referring to is that we get about 3 seconds of naked Chris Pine.
It helped considering we just watched Loro minutes before.
From a distance.
Which a lot of...
Yes. From a distance, but there's nothing left to the imagination. So
it's sad in 2018. Weird. Yeah. But yeah, it is. It's, yeah. We see so much female nudity and we're kind of benumbed to it. And we see male nudity and it's exceptional.
It's a big deal, yeah. So Yeah, I mean, this movie is very much the spiritual successor to Braveheart. In fact, it's not even the spirit. It is Braveheart 2 in many ways, shape and form. I mean, the sequence of events takes place almost immediately after Braveheart. And the Robert the Bruce character, I think, is portrayed quite sympathetically in the movie Braveheart. Although, you know, he is portrayed in that movie as being somewhat weak, in the sense of his unwillingness to stand up to the English. And I think this movie it aims in many ways to address that historical perspective on this particular historical figure. So, you know, it paints us a picture of somebody who, you know, kind of like William Wallace of Braveheart, is forced into this leadership role because of the behavior and the way that the English and the way that the Scottish are being treated by the English. As a film, I found it to be very, very well made technically. Yazdi, you and I had a discussion earlier today about, you know, the first opening scene in the movie being, you know, a 5 or 10 minute unbroken take. I mean,
where a lot of things happen during which
it is, you know, pure theater. We have, you know, a lot of things happen, a lot of characters introduced, a lot of people moving in and out of the scene, a lot of transitions, all done seemingly without a single cut of the camera, almost to the point of distraction slightly, because I think once I noticed it, it's kind of like, you know, when somebody plays the game of, you know, let's not blink. It's, you know, trying to kind of see how long you can last without making a cut. But nonetheless, it's got lots of things like that in it, which show just how accomplished the director is. You know, writing wise, I feel like the movie was just a little bit clunky in places, and I don't want to make that sound overly critical, because, you know, but I did feel that the movie, you know, was very eager to show us its underpinnings rather than allowing us to kind of piece the story together a bit more you know, cleverly, but nonetheless, I mean, I think, you know, it was a really interesting story to tell. I think the battle scenes were brutal. I hadn't seen scenes of this kind of on-screen violence, you know, since something like, you know, perhaps the Revenant had it to some extent in the early scenes, and certainly the original Braveheart. It just reminds us of how gruesome and physical combat would have been back in the day. But it is a really fascinating story. Once again, you know, the English are portrayed absolutely terribly in history, you know, for what they did to Scotland. And again, I think it's a really remarkable, although slightly bloated, piece of cinema.
Yes, Steve.
Yeah, this was one of my most anticipated movies at the film festival, because I have exceptionally high regard for Mackenzie's last movie, which we've all talked about, Hell or High Water, which is such a watershed moment, I think, in Americana, you know, movies about Americana, and it's just about perfect and has so much to say about where we are, about those who have and those who don't, about the human condition. It's just a beautifully rendered movie at every level. So I had exceptionally high expectations, and I didn't even know walking in that this was a full-fledged historical epic. So I think this is a pretty strong off-track wearing, you know, for this particular director. I didn't even know that he had it in him to make this something of this scope. And this is a movie, like Joe, you said, it's exceptional scope, and the production design on this is just incredible. And the reason why I mentioned Netflix early on is I think if this movie were to only show up on Netflix, it would be a disservice, because it's truly an epic, and it's shot, it's a long movie, and it's shot impeccably. So, you know, I think from a visual craft perspective, it's pretty remarkable. Where the disappointment comes in for me is that the movie pretty much, and maybe, you know, he's just a prisoner of what we know historically about, you know, this particular character, but the whole movie just comes across as a series of skirmishes which just get progressively more violent and gory. And, you know, none of that cleverness in writing that we saw in Hell or High Water, none of that, you know, real sense of who the characters are. I mean, everybody, because there's so many characters and so much happening on such a large scale, it's very difficult to get in depth with any of the characters. So they all come off seeming a little shallow, including the main character. So I think that for me was a little bit of disappointment, because I didn't find any cleverness in the movie. But again, it makes up in scale for what it lacks in terms of cleverness. I think the movie does kind of cross the line in the final, you know, last minutes, when it just gets unbearably violent. And, you know, we've seen violence. And this one, the woman sitting next to me, she just closed her eyes and she was just... And it goes on for a while. It's a long
battle
sequence.
It's an epic battle.
It's an epic battle, which goes on and on. I don't know, 15, 20 minutes. And she was she was waiting to exhale. And she had her eyes covered and she couldn't... And I did, for once, I did not think that she was being a wallflower or being overly sensitive. I had the same trouble watching it. So it's no holds barred, all of that. So I think it's still an achievement, but I expected a little bit more. Go on.
I think the epic battle scenes really remind me, if you're an avid watcher of Game of Thrones, this feels very Game of Thrones, real life, historical version.
Yeah. I mean, you know.
And I don't know how much is CGI'd, but it's... It's very epic. No,
it's done very well in camera, I think. And I think, you know, kind of it did feel very reminiscent, almost beat for beat, some of the battles of the, you know, the ones that we saw in Braveheart. You know,
there are similar
tactics used for, you know, battling the heavy horse that the English have. And you know, so it felt, you know, very derivative in that way. And, you know, I felt that the movie, having spent all of the time that it did on those combat scenes, then hurried the story towards the end, in that the ultimate conclusion of the story is told via title cards. And you know, as much as I understand that it's difficult to cram, you know, many decades of history into a 2.5 hour running time, I do feel that they could have probably cut, you know, half an hour of battle scene and given us more about how Robert the Bruce was ultimately able to prevail over the English. So, you know, that's again, minor criticism, but it didn't take away from my enjoyment of the movie at all.
Yeah, and one other thing I want to say before we move to the next movie is, this is definitely another feather in the cap of a Chris Pine, you know, who could... You know, certainly coast on being the pretty face, but, you know, off late he's been taking on very challenging roles. And this is one which, I mean, maybe they could have had somebody marginally better, but, you know, this is a difficult role and he takes it on.
He wears leading actor perfectly well.
Yeah.
I think I just prefer Chris Pine of Horrible Bosses or... you know, of Hell or High Water, where there's something a little bit different about his character and you get to see more sides of him. Mm-hmm. I felt like this is overall good Chris Pine.
Yeah, but again, it speaks to his versatility.
And he brings it. Brings it. You know, there's nothing phoned in about this performance.
I never once thought he was anything other than Scottish in this
Correct.
Movie.
Great accent.
Oh, really?
Yeah, agreed.
That didn't, you know, once. The accent wasn't spot on, but he had the right sensibility of what I believe
a
Scottish nobleman would have
had.
Yeah,
that was an awful haircut.
It was.
He should sue.
But it was very Scottish of that time, I guess.
Back in the day, they had only rudimentary scissors.
Correct. Correct.
Okay.
So. All right. Let's move on then to our third movie of the day, which was Hotel Mumbai. So... Rashmi, you're going to give us the background on that.
Yes, this was Yasky's second most anticipated, if not your first equally anticipated
movie of the festival,
right, Yasky? And we almost lost our tickets because of trying to pick good seats for this one. But anyway, not that I'm rubbing that in at all, because we did have good seats. So anyway, Dev Patel, Armie Hammer, Nazanin Boniardi, who you might know from Homeland, and Anupam Kher, who was most recently in The Big Sick, but has been a longtime favorite Indian actor. He was also the dad in Bend It Like Beckham, which is one of my favorite films. star in Anthony Maras's debut feature about the 2008 Mumbai terrorist attacks and its survivors. So it's set at the Hotel Taj, and many of us watched this unfold on TV as it was happening. And it's mainly told through the eyes of the survivors and the staff at the Taj Hotel. So we were, again, very lucky to see cast and crew. And they actually flew over some of the staff, right? And we can talk a little bit about that once you've given me your views of the movie. So, Yazdi, I'm dying to hear whether this lived up to your expectations. And then, Joe, you can go next. So, Yazdi, what did you think of this? Was this worth the wait?
Yes and no. I think there's no denying that this is a very powerful movie. It's very tense. It works at every minute like the best thrillers ever put on screen. So from that perspective, I think the movie definitely gets the job done. And I think regardless of what you do or don't know about what transpired those three fateful days in, I think, November 26th to 28th, in the early 2000s, I think this will be a nail biter of a movie. I had a few issues with the film. And I don't think it's a perfect film by any chance, but by any means. But I think the issue is that the movie is kind of lives and dies by its premise, which is that this is such a strong plot line, right? This is a true story. This is something which actually transpired, that just telling that story is enough, because it's so incredible that this group of eight people reached, you know, they got into a boat and they arrived on the shores of Mumbai, and during a period of 24 hours did very targeted attacks at major Mumbai landmarks. And, you know, having born and brought up in Mumbai and having family there, I remember how completely debilitating that time was when the whole city was under siege. So there is literally, just like 9/11, there is thousands of stories surrounding that event. And by necessity, this movie can only touch on a few of them. So I think the movie will have its detractors. There'll be people who will say, how dare they didn't show this part, how dare they didn't show that, why did they leave this out, and so forth. But I think as it stands, it's more than capable. It's a darn good thriller. And then we can come back.
Joe, what did you think?
You said that it's, you know, not necessarily the perfect movie. I disagree completely. This movie set out to do one thing, which was essentially put us, the audience, in the shoes of the people that were under siege that day. And I think, it was a deliberate choice to not get into some of the politics around the issue, to not get into some of the motivations of the attackers. This movie was intended to help us as an audience understand what it may have been like to have been caught up in an event as horrific as the attack on the Taj Hotel that day in Mumbai. And we shouldn't forget that there were many other locations. There were several other mm-hmm. locations that were attacked in Mumbai, which the movie, you know, briefly touches upon, but it very much focuses on the hotel. I can't remember a time in recent years where I have been placed in such immediate peril from the way that the movie it plays out the events. Even though we know the story and how it ends and the ultimate fate, the movie creates this incredible sense of tension and chaos. We're given very limited information as the audience as to where the terrorists might be. We attended the director Q&A at the end of the movie, which said that they had actually set out to do that. You know, there were many ways of telling the story. You know, we could see things from outside, and they deliberately chose to withhold that kind of information. So at no point in that movie did anyone, any one of the main characters feel like they were safe. I think it gave us an interesting portrait of the terrorist attackers themselves. I think they were portrayed somewhat sympathetically, but not in a way that you felt pity for them in terms of how brainwashed they were. You did not feel any pity or remorse for them as killers because they were cold. So this movie reduced me to tears at several points, but by the end of it, I was really quite shaken, and I can't remember having felt that way about a movie in a very long time. So a tremendously important story to tell, and a tremendously well executed movie. Performances throughout this, I think, are standout. I do think we are going to hear about this during award season from several portrayals, but amazing, stunning.
What Joe said, wow, I was breathless and speechless and frightened to my very core by this movie. I was literally choking back, being a blubbering mess. And although tears never really exited from my eyes until the very, very end, when it was almost like a sigh of relief that the movie was over in a good way, I just had this horrible feeling in the pit of my stomach. And yes, the idea for to say that you weren't on the edge of your seat, because I counted you jumping back and forth on your seat at least 3 times. I thought you were in trouble. But I mean, you were literally like at the back of your seat, and then you were like on the edge of your seat physically. And Joe, when I looked around at you, I could hear you not breathing at times. So I'm not sitting in the middle of you two again in any movie like this again. But I mean, look, that's just a sign to me that we were sitting in a very affecting and effective movie. Bravo. This is phenomenal. And I would say of the 4 movies we watched, this is my standout favorite of the day. Just phenomenal. And I agree with you. I think we're going to see a lot of love for this during Oscar season.
Yeah, again,
undeservedly so.
Deservedly so. And I think as a thriller, it's just top notch.
It's like a horror movie.
It's like the fact that this all happened in reality, it just adds an extra level of sting that, you know, you imagine yourself in that situation and it's unthinkable. And I think, you know, maybe from a craft perspective, this may not be the most sophisticated movie, you know, ever made. But I think the one great thing this particular director, Anthony Maris, has done is he shows from the start that these terrorists, when they arrive, they just start shooting people. They don't have, there's no interaction. You know, they don't look at who that person is. They are just randomly shooting. And I think it's that, again, that juxtaposition of the everyday common person doing something which is so difficult. When somebody just starts shooting without reason, how do you fight back against that? You know, and it just brings to point why, you know, terror is so terrorizing, because, you know, if you're in a situation where somebody's just shooting at people randomly without reason, it's horror. So I think that's good. I think my two small complaints about the movie is that it really, and it's a script issue. I mean, I think I know stories already from the newspaper, like 9/11. I mean, after 9/11, I just read endlessly about all the stories about all the people who were trapped in 9/11, and it seemed like every person's story who died in 9/11 could have made a movie. So it was the same thing here, you know, every person that I read in the newspaper, and the movie here concentrates only about 4 or 5 main characters, and it's felt to me like I wish the movie had just opened up a little bit in scope, and maybe there should have been a miniseries, but then it couldn't have been a movie, so I don't know. And then the other thing to me is I grew up in Mumbai, and we were never that wealthy enough that we went to the Taj, you know, every weekend, but we went often enough that I know the Taj from the inside and out. And for the right reasons, the Taj even now is a very, very successful, very well-regarded, beautiful landmark in the city. So it must have been very difficult and almost impossible to shoot there. So the entire movie, the inside of the hotel, is shot, I think, in New Zealand.
In Adelaide.
Adelaide, in Adelaide, Australia.
In Australia. So I know that hotel so well that it all seemed fake to me, because I'm like, that's not what their main lobby looks like. That's not what the hotels look like. So it kind of took away from that sense of reality, which is entirely my problem. I think if you've never been there, then it's not going to make any difference.
Yeah, it certainly didn't ruin it for either Joe or I. We've not been lucky enough to go to the actual hotel, although I've seen it from the outside when I was there many, many years ago.
And it does do a great job of kind of cross-stitching actual footage from what happened in real time with what was going on. And it's really a commentary on how to make do with little. You know, the city was entirely unprepared. They did not have a team of people who could deal with this kind of an event. And there were like literally a handful of policemen who were in charge of, you know, doing this. And this particular hostage crisis went on for a good 48 hours. And it's not that everybody escaped. You know, there were so many people who died. Yeah. More than half the staff died. So it's a very tragic story. And I'm glad that it'll see the light of day where people become more aware of this.
Yeah, no, I think that's the part of the movie that I think had me the most crushed emotionally, I think, was that four individuals were able to perpetrate so much terror because essentially there was an information vacuum from the authorities. I think, you know, they could and should have been able to do a lot more sooner. And, you know, I understand that there was no, you know, elite SAS Delta Squad type force available to them in Mumbai. But I think they also had no clue what they were dealing with. They probably thought there were many, many more terrorists than there were, and that their training and sophistication was much higher than essentially being, you know, four teenagers. And, you know, I think...
Well, remember, there's four teenagers just in the hotel. There were other
there were people 10 in total. There were 10 in total. Yeah. And look, you know, the reason that this attack was so successful was because of the sheer chaos that the city was thrown into with multiple coordinated attacks. So, you know, it felt like a war had been started. But again, you know, from an emotional perspective, I think, you know, the loss of life, the loss of innocent life, seems all the more tragic given, you know, the fact that earlier intervention by even limited authorities could have prevented many, many deaths. So, you know, that's the piece where I kind of lost it. And the movie does a very good job of exposing that. And hopefully in a way that prepares us for the future should anything like this ever happen again.
Which we hope it doesn't. So two things. One is... I think the genius of this movie is that it really shows how everyday people become heroes,
mm-hmm.
right? This is just everyday people who choose to do an action or not do an action.
And specifically you're referring to the staff of the hotel.
Not just the staff, but also guests who help other guests. That was one beautiful thing. And I think the other thing that really struck me about this movie was there were absolute times of no music. The film does a really good job of knowing when to have music and when not to have music, and a large part of the event is done without music. It's the music is the silence, and that was extremely effective for me.
Yeah.
So bravo, phenomenal movie.
Yeah, people should go out and watch it, and I think there's nobody again that I would not recommend this movie to. And I should also say that Armie Hammer should send a box of chocolates to whoever his agent is, because he's having a phenomenal year. He started with Free Fire, Call Me By Your Name, Sorry to Bother You. He is in Hotel Mumbai, and he's in another movie based on real life events of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, which opens in a couple months, called On the Basis of Sex. So whatever his agent is doing for him, it's working great for him. And likewise, Dave Patel, while he's at it, he should send a box of chocolates as well to his.
Yeah.
Because, you know, Dave Patel, you know, he's a British actor. You know, he didn't seem that versatile when he first broke the scene with Slumdog Millionaire. But, you know, he's doing good work with Lion Lust a couple of years ago. And now he's in two movies this year.
Both playing at TIFF. One which we're hoping to catch tomorrow.
Yeah. So, yeah, both of them really good. And Anupam Kher is just so good. Yeah. Oh, I mean, the great Indian actors, really, they're hard to beat. And he, you know why he's a good actor. He plays the head hotel chef in the movie.
Who also was the real person was actually attending the screening.
Was responsible for saving many lives.
Many, many lives through quick thinking and, really appropriate, disaster management in many ways. Yeah, Hotel Mumbai.
It's not the last you've heard of this
stunning
one.
Stunning and, let's... it's, I think, the very first of what will be a series of accolades and awards. Okay, let's move on then to our final movie of the day, which was Gloria Bell. So, Yazdi, I think you're going to give us a little bit of a background on that.
Yes, I will. So, director Sebastian Lelio broke onto the consciousness of international film audiences a few years ago with the movie Gloria, which was nominated for Best Foreign Film. It played in cinemas, and it's really quite something else. The lead actress in there was at that time in contention for an Oscar as well. She obviously, it's very hard for
foreign language
actors to get nominated, but after that, he kind of has been on an exceptionally good role, because last year he directed a movie called A Fantastic Woman, which was nominated for Best Foreign Film and actually landed up winning Best Foreign Film Oscar. And on the heels of that, right after the Oscars, he came out with a movie which was set entirely in London within the Jewish community. The movie called Disobedience. So just to give you an idea of the versatility. Which we reviewed on our show a little while earlier. And here we have this particular director now, in the Q&A after the movie where Julianne Moore was present, we found out that Julianne Moore was a big, big, big fan of the original movie Gloria. And, when she met the director, she kept saying how much she liked the movie. And eventually the two decided to do an English language adaptation of that movie. So it has a similar name. Instead of Gloria, we have Gloria Bell. And the lead character is played by Julianne Moore. And John Turturro is here. Michael Cera plays her son. And it's essentially the story of a woman of a certain age who's just trying to find her sea legs. And she is she's somebody who inherently loves music and gets a lot of enjoyment from that, but all that's available to her in terms of the genetic pool is these older men at these dance clubs, and she's trying to connect with someone. She's been divorced since 10 years. She has grown children. And it's really about her dealing with her grown children, trying to connect with somebody else in life and just find her footing. And that's really all Gloria Bell is. We happen to be at the world premiere of the movie where the stars and the director and the lead actor, Julianne Moore, was there. What do you guys think about Gloria Bell?
I mean, sign her up for the nomination already. Miss Julianne Moore, you're going to have a nomination. This is a great movie and a great vehicle to show off how amazing both Julianne Moore and John Turturro are. I haven't seen John Turturro in a movie for a long time, and I certainly haven't seen him do a significant role like this. But my, these are two actors who are great. This was a really well-crafted, well-paced, beautifully measured movie about life and people and love and the shit that goes down. I love this movie. I absolutely love this movie. And what I marveled at the most was how quickly we established who each character was and how each character walking onto the scene, even if they're only in it for one scene or two, we knew exactly who they were and where they fit into the story of this woman's life. Fantastic. Loved it.
Joseph?
This isn't necessarily my flavor of movie, and so I have to kind of temper my review with that. But I agree, Rashmi. This movie has an emotional core to it that puts us in the shoes of a woman of a certain age, and the camera never seems to leave Julianne Moore. I mean, the movie's running time is, an hour and 50,
Just under 2 hours, I think.
Yeah, just under 2 hours running time. And it feels like...
102 minutes.
Oh, 100. Okay, so yeah, substantially less than we thought. But that's not to say the movie dragged in any way. The whole time the camera feels as if it's focused on Julianne Moore. And it's such an open and honest and...
naked.
Emotionally revealing performance that I think... you know, it's clear that you mentioned Diaz D. She had some affiliation with the character from the previous remake. And I should add that I haven't seen the original Gloria. So I think, Diaz D., you have, and I'll be interested to hear the comparison. Because, you know, clearly she has a certain amount of this woman within her, the insecurities, the confidence, ability to kind of dance with abandon, because, you know, as a woman, that's what she, you know, loves to do. And the way that she shows us those very intimate personal moments, such as, you know, singing in the car, that kind of thing. So as a performance movie, it's fantastic. I think plot wise I struggled to some extent to go on its complete ride. I think the John Turturro character, as well acted as he was, I had some difficulties in believing who he was and who his motivations were. But I mean, this is an extraordinarily well crafted movie. It shows the actress at the top of her game. I think, Rashmi, you're right. She's going to be on many a short list for Best Actress come the end of the year. And, just a very, very strong, solid, engaging, emotionally touching movie.
Yeah, of all the... I never thought I would say this, but of all the four movies we saw on day one, this actually, in spite of Hotel Mumbai and in spite of Outlaw King, this is actually the movie which won my heart. Mm. But this is my kind of movie, and which is surprising because I've seen the movie before, the original movie, Gloria, and, you know, the female actor there, she's incredible. And more so, this movie is almost a scene-by-scene remake. It doesn't deviate that much from the original movie. But it's... You know, it's a character study in the best sense of the word. Okay, this is a movie which just wants to tell you about this particular character, Gloria, and about everything about her. And like you said, it's such an honest, open performance. And I think it's the small things in life, you know, which ultimately make up how you feel and what you do and your sense of self. And it just conveys that so beautifully here. And also, you know, I think people get fed up. They're like, yeah, here's another Nicole Kidman movie, here's another Meryl Streep movie, here's another Julianne Moore movie. But you watch a movie like this and you realize this is why these actors keep getting hired. I mean, you know, people kind of thought, oh, well, she got the Oscar for Still Alice because it was her time, but she really wasn't that good. No, she was good. And see how good she is here. And, you know, I don't know, she's 57 years old and, you know, she's in a...
Flawless. You
know, she's flawless and she's in a small group of actors right now who I can consider who are just game for just inhabiting this character, breathing this character. And, you know, a lesser movie would have just shown all her triumphs, you know, just shown this woman prevailing against the odds. But no, I mean, the movie is interested in all those things that you're proud of. And it also shows all the things that, you know, all of us do that we are not proud of. I mean, she's flawed and she makes stupid mistakes and she does things, but she's so entirely human. You know, by the time the last song came on, I was clapping along, and I think the entire audience was clapping along because we want to see this character land on her feet. And does she land on her feet? I don't think so, but she makes one small step in the right direction. And that's enough. And that's what life is. And it just filled me up and it made me happy. And it made me happy for actors who can do this. This is the hardest thing to do. This movie doesn't have a plot, like you said, Joe. It's about this woman dealing with her grown kids and their problems, trying to find love late in her life and just trying to find a sense of who she is. That's all the movie is. There is nothing more to it but to make something living and breathing and real, I think is quite remarkable. I just love this movie.
I mean, I'm looking at her filmography. I mean, the last few films she's done, she's played very varied roles from, you know, the strange wife in Maggie's Plan, which was that great mm-hmm. Greta Gerwig movie with Ethan Hawke. She was in Kingsman. Remember, she was the baddie in the Kingsman.
Right.
She was the great sort of mistress in Suburbicon. And now, mm-hmm. you know, Gloria Bell.
She's in the Hunger Games.
I mean, yeah, she was in the Hunger Games. But I mean, this to me is perfection, Julianne Moore. I mean, just... And again, even Brad Garrett.
Oh, yeah.
He's not Brad in it for Garrett. Long, but I mean, everyone is so good in this movie. Michael and Cera, I know what you're saying about John Turturro being sort of like...
Joe was saying.
Yeah, I think, Joe, you were saying it's kind of a bit overcooked, maybe. But, I mean...
I completely bought it.
Yeah. I couldn't figure out, is this an affair or is this something real happening? I couldn't figure it out.
From her perspective,
and that's how love is, right?
Yeah, from where she's seeing, this is what she's seeing.
Sure,
who knows what his truth is?
And
but
even
this
her
is
son
what
and her daughter.
This is true. I think you know the thing that I struggled with the John Turturro character was his kind of inconsistent behavior. So his
well, that's how men are to women.
That's complexity in life. Everybody is a ball of complexities, I think, and contradictions. Yeah.
Yeah, I needed for him to be a bit more masculine than he was.
But, you know, Rita Wilson is here, Tom Hanks'
yes,
wife, in,
yes.
in a little role. She's perfect.
Yes.
Taylor Holland is here as, a,
Michael
as her mom.
Cera.
Michael Cera is there as her son. These are all people who come in and out. They're there for maybe 3 or 4 minutes, but boy, do they all
yeah.
knock
and
it out
And
they
all
of the
leave
park.
Their mark.
They all do. Yeah, it's just
what a
authentic.
Great day of movie watching.
Yeah.
4 amazing films. I mean... Look, we picked these 2 weeks ago, Yazdi. Mm-hmm. We did a sort of a review, Yazdi and I did. I mean, I knew nothing about this movie. This was kind of my risk movie of the day, but I know you wanted to see it, which is why we kind of got the last showing of the day. Fantastic pick.
Yeah, it was...
So good.
All 4 movies, I think, were
incredible. You know, every time we cover Tribeca in particular, I talk about the hit or miss nature of film festivals, and you know, so far so good. I think the
There's
first
no
day
misses.
Of Tribeca, I've seen possibly, you know, 4 of the best movies of the year in terms of the top, you know, 10, yeah. 15 movies. Mm-hmm. There's 3, I think, that will resonate for me and will be definitely high on my personal list of movies come the end of the year. So, you know, great job again, Tiff, for selecting these movies, for showing these movies, for giving them the attention that I think all 4 of them deserve. And, you know, I think, Yazdi, we've spoken oftentimes about the timing of TIFF as it relates to the kind of the end of the year awards. And I think, you know, this is it's kind of a magical moment, right? The timing of the festival coincides with when the movies need to start making their
campaigns,
you know, their campaigns
to the Oscar.
For the Oscars. Yeah. But also this town's a very apparent love for movie and for film. Yeah. Makes it the appropriate venue to, you know, release these movies. You get, you know, a lot of interested and passionate people about film here. So, terrific first day here at Toronto International Film Festival. It's Rashmi and I's first time here and our first time covering it for MovieWala. As Yazdi, I can see why you have been here on multiple occasions in the past.
And fallen in love, yeah.
We will definitely make a point of participating either as civilians or as press, you know, given the opportunity moving forward. It's been a terrific first day. So, again, to recap, we saw Loro, Hotel Mumbai, Gloria Bell, and
Outlaw/King.
So, I guess we should wrap up the podcast for now. We've been running here just over an hour. So hope you enjoyed the podcast. We'll be back soon with more coverage from Toronto International Film Festival. Hopefully within the next day or two as we cover our next helping of movies from the festival. Until then, it's midnight and then some here in Toronto when we have an early start tomorrow. So too many movies, too little time, never truer than at a film festival. A good night from me.
And me.
And me as well.